in my academic and non-academic life. One, Victor Koshman just kindly mentioned some of my books that I've done. There's one book called Across the Pacific that was published in 1969, which was a study of mutual perceptions, Chinese-Japanese images of America and American images of Japan and China. It was in connection with that study that I paid my last visit to Cornell. Therefore, it was really already about 1964-65, almost 20 years ago that I came here to study the papers of Willard Strait. Because his ideas, the images he had and so on, to me provided a very good example of one kind of American perceptions of Japan in particular, but China too, at the turn of the century. I have since been very interested in pursuing this, even though I'm sometimes embarrassed to note that my own ideas about mutual perceptions really have not changed that much in the past 20 years. Nothing terribly original, I'm afraid I have written for some time on that topic. The second activity that I'm pursuing now is to study the 1930s in somewhat greater detail. I have a deadline of December 31st this year with a British publisher to write a book on the origins of the Second World War. I'm not sure if we're going to make the deadline, but I'm trying to write that. And there, my preoccupation has been much more detailed, much more document-based study of a step-by-step coming of the war in 1941. That has been done by many people, of course, but I thought since there already exist 2,000 books on the origins of the war, there could be 2,001 books on the topic also. The third activity is not so much scholarly or academic as journalistic. Victor also mentioned that I do spend some time in Japan every year, a couple of months each year, and part of my attempted activity there is to write things for the Japanese audience. It's more journalistic than scholarly. But there too, I guess what I'm trying to do is to say things that might have some impact on Japanese perceptions of the West, of the United States and other Western countries, because I do feel that the current situation, as I will mention in this paper, is not as good as it could be. Well, with that as opening statements, let me read what I have written. And I would, of course, welcome your comments and suggestions at the end. Japanese images of the West, which is the topic of the assignment I was given here. Japanese images of the West are usually presented as a juxtaposition of admiration and aversion. On one hand, the Japanese are said to have worshipped things European and American, and to have changed and to have engaged themselves in a collective effort to emulate them. On the other hand, it has also been noted that from time to time, the Japanese have reacted violently against the West, or rather against their own coping after the West. This theme of admiration for and xenophobic reaction against the West has been pointed out by numerous writers, among the most recent of whom one may count Marius Janssen in his book, Japan and the World, or the journalist Robert Christopher, his book, The Japanese Mind, that was published a year ago. But this theme itself goes back to Lafcad Yohan at the turn of the century, or even before then, to Ernest Sato, for example, and other Western diplomats as early as the 1850s. In a sense, there has been a consistency in Western images of Japanese images of the West. But Japanese writers have also been impressed with the same dichotomy. They have noted that since the mid-19th century, the country has tried to emulate the West politically, economically, and culturally, but at the same time that there has remained an undercurrent of misunderstanding and hostility between the two. All such generalizations are valid as far as they go. And it is undoubtedly possible to trace modern Japanese-Western relations in terms of the interplay between admiration and reaction, or even attraction and revulsion. Superficially, at least, one could schematize this process and argue that the initial Japanese hostility toward the West from the 1850s to the 1860s was followed by a period of turning to the West as a model, which then led in the 1890s to nationalistic reaction. Although that was short-lived and the country went on transforming itself into a Western-style power in the first decades of the 20th century, it also encountered difficulties, particularly with regard to emigration overseas, and immigration disputes with the United States, Canada, and other countries produced a view of Japan and the West as fundamentally irreconcilable. That view was submerged for a while in the 1920s, a decade of self-conscious identification culturally as well as economically and diplomatically with the West. But it in turn produced its antithesis in the next decade of the 1930s, characterized by an unprecedented degree of hostility toward the West. The 1930s, as historians have pointed out, saw Japan isolating itself from the world, self-righteously proclaiming its xenophobic doctrine of the national essences and rejecting European and American influences. That confrontation led to war, which in turn brought about Japan's wholesale capitulation to Western power and civilization. After 1945, in this broad overview, one could see Japan turning once again to the West for inspiration, even for salvation, as it sought to rise from the ruins of war. The process may not have ended, but it is possible to argue that just as had happened earlier in the century, Japan's very identification with the West and its success in coping from it have created tensions in Japanese-Western relations. Increasingly, Japanese have been saying that they are, in fact, number one in the world, that there is little they can learn from the West, while Westerners have been accusing the Japanese of arrogance and self-centeredness. As I said, there is some validity to this sort of a cyclical interpretation. Japanese images of the West will continue to fluctuate between admiration and reaction. This will be the case so long as the Japanese continue to be fascinated, as they always seem to have been, with the problem of collective identity. Identity, in fact, has entered the Japanese vocabulary. It is itself a revealing phenomenon. Of thousands of Western concepts, the concept over the word identity is one that the Japanese have clasped with alacrity. It is because the word implies exactly the kind of existential predicament they feel they are boxed in by. What is Japan's identity, they ask? Has its westernization made it Western? Does it still remain a non-Western nation? If so, is it Asian or is it something else? Is it so unique that it cannot be described in any other way than that it is Japanese? These questions are asked today, and literally hundreds of books have been published on Japanese national character. But the collective obsession with national identity is nothing new. It started the moment the Japanese resumed their contact with the West in the 19th century, and the intensity with which the question has been posed and examined for over a century does seem to indicate that the dual theme of admiration for and reaction against the West had some basis in the psychology of the nation. All this is undoubtedly true, but I would like to examine Japanese images of the West by putting them in the context of the modern world experience, modern world history. But first of all, we should keep in mind that the theme of attraction and revulsion toward the foreigner is virtually a universal phenomenon, not limited to Japanese, now or in the past. After all, the history of mankind is a story of interactions among groups of people. And from the earliest moments of recorded history in ancient Assyria, Babylonia, down to Egypt, Greece, and Rome, India, China, as far as I have been able to determine, how to deal with aliens has been a central theme for all peoples. Japan is but a latecomer in this process, and there is nothing extraordinary about Japanese images of the West. Even the most avid coping after the West, or xenophobic reaction against it, is no more extraordinary than similar responses in ancient civilizations, whose history was a chronicle of borrowing from and discriminating against alien peoples. But I think the Japanese case is significant, if not unique, because it is part of contemporary history. Japan's westernization and its attempted de-westernization have affected the destinies of millions, not merely in Asia, but throughout the world. Because of this, I would like to say something about these phenomena, or these concepts of westernization and de-westernization. Usually the term modernization is used to describe the transformation of Japan and other countries, but in this context I prefer the word westernization, since we are talking about images and self-perceptions and it seems to make more sense to refer to Western rather than modern images and self-perceptions. For instance, Japan's cultural borrowing in such fields as literature, visual arts, and music was not limited to modern Western civilization, any more than the Japanese confined their study of Western philosophy to post-18th century European philosophers. When we consider how the Japanese have changed their ideas, habits, tastes, and ways of life since the 19th century, we may say that what we are talking about is their individual and collective consciousness, or collective cultural memory. It would seem that in cultural memory or cultural consciousness, the distinction between modern and pre-modern is too arbitrary to be of much analytical use. But we cannot understand contemporary Japanese cultural consciousness without recognizing the layers that have been built by European and American influences. Conversely, periodic attempts to reassert Japan's uniqueness and identity are efforts to get rid of those layers so that what presumably lies underneath them may reveal itself in pristine purity. In reality, however, these layers are so intricately interwoven that it will be difficult to separate them out or to eliminate some of them and keep the rest. Let me illustrate what I'm trying to say by going back to the 1930s, when the view that Japan was becoming too westernized for its own good and that the process should be reversed was very prominent. I would argue that the story of the decade was not the simple one of the so-called Japan's revolt against the West, as has so often been presented. It is true that governmental spokesman after spokesman and intellectual leader after leader called on the Japanese people to cleanse themselves of the taint of Western civilization. From around 1932, when Japan was roundly denounced at the League of Nations for its aggression in Manchuria, but more vociferously after 1937, when war broke out with China, and China was seen to have the support of most of the Western nations, Japanese officials and writers harped on the theme that the nation must return to its essences and reject the pernicious influences of European and American civilization. Even some of the earlier westernizers, and here somebody like Nitto Binazzo might be cited, this is a year when everybody in Japan is talking about Nitto Binazzo, the educator, scholar, public official, because this, I think, is the 100th anniversary of Nitobe studying at Johns Hopkins. There was a big celebration when I was there in Japan in June this year. There was a big Johns Hopkins delegation to Japan in honor, in part, of Dr. Nitobe, who was one of the Japanese graduates. There was a ceremony to confer an honorary degree on the Prime Minister. Alongside with that, there was a fundraising campaign so that they could establish an Edwin War Rice Hour Center at Johns Hopkins. They all come together in the name of Nitobe. It's very interesting to see how this works. But Nitobe also is going to be very famous on the 1st of November this year, because his picture is going to be on the 5,000 yen notes. The Japanese paper notes are going to be all changed beginning the 1st of November, and Nitobe is going to be on 5,000 yen. So everybody now talks about Nitto Binazzo as the big modern westernizer, someone who, as he said, tried to build bridges across civilizations. But it seems to me, I think, only necessary and I think honest to point out that even somebody like him and many of others who had been advocating Japan's westernization and so on in the 1930s were beginning to say that Westerners really did not understand Japan, and that the Japanese could never hope to make them understand Japan. There was, in other words, an unbridgeable gap between Japan and the West. Under the circumstances, they pointed out, Japan must simply be Japanese and do what it thought was right. It was only a step from such reasoning to a more vociferous anti-Westernism that saw, even in the senseless war in China, a moral crusade to purge Asia of Western influence. The anti-Westernizing crusade reached a climax during the Pacific War, which was defined by Japan's leaders as a cultural as well as a military conflict. It was to be the culmination of their efforts to construct a new culture in Asia and the world to replace the predominant influence of the West. Yet such an effort at national mobilization for de-Westernization only revealed its own futility. Few are taking de-Westernization literally, which would have meant taking Japan back where it had been in the mid-19th century. Even the most strident exponents of the idea would not want that. If anything, what they wanted was for Japan to extend its control over the whole of Asia and even beyond. And the anti-Western propaganda was but a justification for such an undertaking. To rid Asia of Western power and influence was, for such people, the same thing as entrenching Japan's control over the region. For such spokesmen, the West here primarily meant modern European and American imperialism. They would eject it to return Japan and Asia to the days before the coming of Western imperialists, but then they would replace it with their own imperialism. Moreover, some of the academic and military imperialists in Japan rationalized their ideas by citing Machiavelli, Haushofer, and other theorists of realpolitik. Foreign Minister Matsuoka, for instance, in justifying Japan's belligerent stance toward the United States, wrote in 1940 that the nation must learn from Machiavelli and act like other powers that had practiced realpolitik. Other Japanese writers were fond of citing Haushofer to explain why the nation needed the resources of Greater Asia. There was nothing anti-Western about such ideas. Those ideas were very much part of the Western tradition. In fact, as I have tried to indicate in my essay elsewhere, the bulk of Japanese writings on war, diplomacy, geopolitics, and even on Asian history and geography throughout the 1930s and during the war consisted of translations from European and American books. As one author pointed out in 1938, the Japanese knew too little about the non-Western parts of the world. Even the military were ignorant of China and Southeast Asia as they launched the aggressive wars in these areas. It was in part to overcome this ignorance that Japanese spokesmen called on the people to stop being fascinated with things Western and turn their attention to these other lands. But in most instances, they had to comb European and American sources to learn about them. As late as 1944, one finds a prominent scientist lamenting the fact that Japanese were still heavily dependent on Western scholarship for much of what they knew. So it can be seen that the de-Westernizing campaign was in reality a response to the fact that Japan remained under strong Western influence. The more it remained so, the stronger grew the voices denouncing the West, but it was essentially a futile exercise. Another inherent contradiction in the de-Westernization of the 1930s is that even while the Japanese talked about revolting against the West, they were succumbing to the influence of Italian fascism and German Nazism. The signing of the Axis Alliance in 1940 could be explained as a Machiavellian venture, as Matsuoka did, but many did not want simply to dismiss it as an unprincipled diplomatic ploy. They saw Germany and Italy as, quote, newly rising nations or newly growing powers, with which Japan was to identify itself. Add to this the Soviet Union, which Japan was also wooing at the time, then it becomes clear that what they were talking about was the formation of a global alliance against what was viewed as the old order. That order was seen as having been defined and dominated by Britain and the United States. These two powers, with the support of France, Holland, a few other European countries, had, it was pointed out time and again, controlled the world's markets and resources. They had established a string of colonies and bases everywhere and stood for the status quo. Against them were countries such as Germany, Italy, the Soviet Union, and Japan, determined to change the status quo and reduce the power of the Anglo-American nations. Such thinking underlay Japanese diplomacy in 1940 and beyond, and reflected the view that the West was not a monolith, but was divided against itself. At this level, therefore, de-Westernization meant de-Anglo-Americanization, to reduce and to put an end to what was seen as the Anglo-American monopoly of power and resources. It was also to entail a cultural anti-Anglo-Americanism. Japan's de-Westernization in the late 1930s and the early 1940s was directed against capitalism, liberalism, parliamentary democracy, and all those ingredients of the modern West that had been best embodied in Britain and the United States. In attacking such ingredients as irrelevant to the needs of the nation, or to the aspirations of the rest of the world, Japanese writers again turned to writings in Germany, Italy, or the Soviet Union. It was not very difficult to find in these countries what they were looking for. For instance, the detailed diary of Yabe Teiji, who was a professor of political science at Tokyo University, is as good a place as any to find ample evidence that many of the critical ideas about Anglo-American institutions that the Japanese held in the 1930s originated in German writings. If not in German writings, then Italian and Soviet publications. For, as Miles Fletcher has pointed out in his book, The Search for a New Order, there was receptiveness to both corporatist and Marxist critiques of bourgeois liberalism in Japan throughout the decade. The picture becomes even more complicated since at that time, American and British writers too were talking about the crisis of liberalism and capitalism and Western civilization. They provided ammunition to anyone so inclined to castigate Britain, the United States, and other democracies for their failure to prevent the coming of an unprecedented depression or to come up with workable measures to recover from it, except by repudiating liberalism itself. Just to cite one example, American critics of President Roosevelt, ranging from Walter Lippmann to Charles Lindbergh, were avidly read by Japanese intellectuals who eagerly parroted the idea that Roosevelt had become a dictator, little different from Hitler or Stalin. Tsurumi Yusuke, the American educated writer, who in 1929 had written that the Americanization of Japan was the best thing that could ever happen to his country, remarked on the eve of Pearl Harbor that the America of President Roosevelt was no longer the America of his dreams. That is, Tsurumi's dreams. In such a context, to be against the United States was not necessarily to oppose traditional American institutions, but to lament their subversion by an aberrant leader and the people who supported him. They had betrayed their own principles, and Japan was going to remind them of this betrayal. This sounds rather fantastic, but such an idea was taken quite seriously by influential officials. For example, Prime Minister Tojo himself argued during the war that America and Britain had not been true to their own ideals of freedom, justice, and equality. How else, he asked, could they have maintained their control over millions of people overseas or discriminated against minorities at home? Japan, Tojo said, was going to put into practice these very ideals in Asia. Of course, this was rather blatant wartime propaganda, but at least it shows the difficulties the Japanese encountered in denouncing Britain and America wholesale. Official spokesmen during the war, from Foreign Minister Shigemitsu on down, never tired of pointing out that it was President Wilson, for example, who had betrayed the principle of racial equality, or that his successors had not been true to the spirit of the Washington Conference. What the Japanese were trying to do in going to war against America in such a context was to remind Americans of their own tradition and to exhort them to be true to it. If that were done, Shigemitsu said, then Japan would have won the war even if it lost the battle. Although highly abstract, such thinking shows that the Japanese were still operating within an imported Western frame of reference. Ideas such as justice, freedom, and equality had come from the West, as did the tendency to view a foreign war as a crusade. At the verbal level, therefore, there was really little distinction between the alleged anti-Westernism of Japan and the ideologies of its Western enemies. It might be objected that words may have been identical, but what they implied was not. Concepts like justice may have meant one thing in the Anglo-American context and quite another in the Japanese. That, of course, is true, but the important thing to note here is that in trying to concretize their rejection of the West, the Japanese in the 1930s and 1940s were entirely unsuccessful in devising their own vocabulary or their own new set of ideas. Their images of the West were increasingly negative and hostile, but the words to express such hostility were derived from the West. The de-Westernization campaign might have been more successful if it had had the support of other non-Westerners, in particular the Chinese. Throughout these years, the Japanese tried to persuade themselves and persuade the Chinese that the two people were brothers and that they should cooperate in a noble struggle against the West. There was, of course, something rather obscene about mouthing such slogans when Japanese soldiers were massacring Chinese civilians by hundreds of thousands, and when Japanese merchants, petty officials, were treating the Chinese population as something much less than their brothers. But the delusion that China was at the bottom more friendly toward Japan than toward the West persisted to the very end. This delusion expressed itself, for instance, in repeated peace overtures to Chungking between 1937 and 1945. Tokyo's highest officials shared many intellectuals' view that there was something that united the two peoples, and therefore that if only the Chinese saw the light, they would join forces with the Japanese to rid Asia of American, British, or Soviet influence. The reality, of course, was the exact opposite. These were the very years when China's identification with the West, particularly with the democracies, grew. Chinese leaders of all persuasions believed that their country's deliverance from Japanese aggression lay in strengthening the ties to America, Britain, the Soviet Union, and other Western countries. The formation in 1941 of an alliance among China, the United States, Britain, and the Dutch East Indies, the so-called ABCD nations, was evidence that the Chinese identified their fate with that of the Western powers. Despite such a clear indication of the failure to woo China, and despite the formidable combination of China and the West, Japanese officials and publicists persisted in the belief that the two would sooner or later, that is China and the West, would sooner or later come apart, and that the Chinese would prefer submission to Japan rather than to America or Britain. The Chinese example seems to show that Japanese images of the West implied images of the non-West, in particular Asia. In the dichotomous scheme between East and West, Japan was to identify with the East against the West, and that all peoples in the East would or should follow Japan's lead. If they did not, it was because they were still too influenced by the West. But what were the factors that set Asians apart from Westerners? Here, Japanese spokesmen argued tautologically that Asia was characterized by the absence of whatever Western traits that they chose to enumerate. Takada Yasuma, a highly respected sociologist, lent his prestige to this sort of exercise by writing essay after essay on the alleged unity of all Asia. According to him, there was something called Asianness, which was defined as the opposite of Westernness, which is emphasis on material and personal well-being as opposed to spiritual communal welfare and harmony. This latter concept, harmony, was often singled out as the one ideal that all Asia understood or embodied. The discovery of harmony may have been a key intellectual development of the 1930s. It survived the disastrous war and has in fact influenced Japanese thinking up to this day. Somehow Japanese writers for the past 50 years have been fond of saying that harmony is a unique national characteristic or a unique Asian characteristic, as the case may be. It would be interesting to investigate how this obsession with the concept of harmony originated. I rather suspect that it too had its modern roots, not the ancient historical roots, but in modern roots in some European or American observations on Japanese life and culture. If that is the case, it is once again an instance of Japan's verbal and conceptual westernization. Enough has been said to indicate that westernization or de-westernization are concepts that are not really exact opposites, but that both are part of a larger process of cultural transfers and transformation in the modern world. Moreover, the story of Japan's westernization or de-westernization reminds us that the West itself is constantly changing and is often divided into competing fragments. Like any other peoples, the Japanese have chosen aspects of European and American civilization to copy and to borrow from, and they have modified what they have borrowed so that the westernization of Japan amounts to Japanization of the West in Japan. European and American ideas, institutions, tastes, ways of life all undergo modification and become Japanized. But there is nothing unique about this phenomenon. After all, a key theme in the history of the United States has been the ways in which European ideas about power, property, contract, and so on have been modified in a new environment. It is little to be wondered at that the same process has gone on in other lands. But to say that Western influences have been mediated through the Japanese environment is not to deny the fact of Westernization. Too often, Japanese and non-Japanese observers alike have lamented the superficiality of the process and argue that at the bottom, the people have remained unchanged, that is, have remained Japanese. Such an interpretation, I think, says more about those making it than about what is actually taking place. It would be very simple indeed if we could dismiss all instances of cross-cultural transfers as skin deep and posit unchanging national traits as a key to understanding different cultures. But if we did so, there will be little point in studying history or any other subjects, as we would know all the answers to begin with. But to the extent that we are interested in cultural consciousness and cultural transfers, we must allow for possibilities of choice and transformation and plurality. Such considerations lead me to view the current situation in Japan with some concern. There appears to have been a resurgence of cultural chauvinism, the idea that Japan is so unique that no other people may understand it. The search for Japan-ness has characterized writings by intellectuals and pseudo-intellectuals in the recent years. Much of the recent critique of the post-war educational system, for example, is reminiscent of the de-Westernization campaign of the 1930s. The critics have pointed out